Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony Orchestra opens its season with a gala opening concert this Saturday evening at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center as pianist John Kimura Parker, noted recording artist, performs the Brahms Piano Concerto No. 2 with the orchestra. We'll get a preview of the concert with the orchestra's principal guest conductor, Daniel Heggie. Plus, we'll meet one of the orchestra's executive musicians, clarinetist and bass clarinetist Angela Carter, who also serves as the development director for the musician-run orchestra. She'll give us some insight into the workings of this artist-run arts organization. The gala concert takes place tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock at the Chapman Music Hall, the Tulsa PAC, and will feature Béla Bartók's Miraculous Mandarin Suite, along with two Hungarian dances by Brahms, along with the concerto. Daniel Heggie and Angela Carter are my guests today. Daniel and Angela, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Thanks.
And this is a big start to the season. I know, Angela, for you, as a member of the orchestra, it's always great to get playing again. But also, as the development director of a musician-run orchestra, this is sort of a big concert for you as well.
It is. We've been trying to start this tradition of the opening night celebration. We started it last year when Joshua Bell was in town for our anniversary, and it went so well and everyone had such a great time that we thought we would continue it. So we have some surrounding events before and after the concert. And this year we are putting up a big tent on the Williams Green between the PAC and the Hyatt. And we are having a patrons dinner beforehand. It's sold out, but it's going to be very exciting and people will notice it walking by because our caterer, which is Kevin Snell with Amelia's new restaurant downtown, he specializes in a type of Argentinian wood-fired cooking, and we actually are having him erect this 6-foot-tall fire outside on the grounds where he will be cooking all day long on Saturday. So if you are downtown and you smell something delicious, that is the meal for the patrons' dinner that is preceding the concert.
So it sounds like this tradition's taking off. And in many, many large orchestras, it's very traditional to have a gala opening night where your patrons are coming in black tie. Is that the sort of atmosphere you're looking for, or that's something different?
Yeah, that's what we're going for. There are so many other big cities that are doing this, and to my knowledge, it hasn't been done very much in Tulsa, but we're trying it out, and people seem to be really excited about that. The Tulsa Symphony, of course, our musicians perform for a lot of other organizations, but we typically have the first concert at the PAC as far as Tulsa nonprofit performing arts goes. So we thought, hey, why don't we do this and just give everybody a chance to really kick off the performance season downtown and do it with a bang.
Now, your patrons' party is sold out, but there is a special gala ticket, correct?
That's right. We have a few of those left. We have a post-concert party back in the tent also, and it's $150, and that actually includes your concert ticket. And following the concert, you get access to our exclusive post-concert party where John Kimura Parker, our guest soloist, will be. And we have mixologists from Mixco, which are doing craft cocktails, one of which is called the Miraculous Mandarin.
Oh, nice.
And then we have music by the Jeff Shadley Quartet, and we're trying to create that tradition of it really being a great party to kick off the season.
All right. Well, with a great party, you need a great concert, Daniel.
That's right.
So tell us about the concert.
Well, we have a wonderful program framed with works by Brahms. And in the middle is Bartók's Miraculous Mandarin. So we begin with two Hungarian dances by Brahms, the first and the fifth. And then, of course, we do a work by a Hungarian composer. So there's the link there. And on the second half, we do Brahms' second piano concerto with John Kimura Parker playing. And actually, that piece was premiered in Budapest, of all places. So there's even a connection there. So it's kind of a Hungarian night.
So instead of Argentina cuisine, you should have had, like, you know, a goulash night or something.
Yeah. You make it work, yeah.
Yeah. So the first work on the concert, the two Hungarian dances, a lot of times you'll see those on Pops performances, but on a classics concert, that's a little different, isn't it?
A little bit different, but, you know, it's signature Brahms. And with the kind of program we have, we wanted to really make sure that it was well-balanced in many ways, because you have the Brahms, the big Brahms work on the second half. You have the Bartók, which we believe may be a premiere here in Tulsa, which is very exciting. So we thought, what could start the program? Let's make a Brahms connection. And these are great curtain raisers, as it were. So these two pieces, actually, they're Hungarian dances that most people know, probably, even if they think they don't know them.
They'll recognize them. They've heard the melody. Them. Right,
yeah.
Right. used in cartoons and all sorts of
other
things.
Yeah, it's been used in so much of pop culture.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Miraculous Mandarin. That is, as you mentioned, this is, as far as you know, it's not been performed in Tulsa. In fact, if you go back to the original ballet, it was banned immediately after the premiere. It's sort of an interesting piece. It was an interesting ballet that went along with it. It's a weird story.
Yeah, very strange story.
And very dark story.
It's a dark story. Bartok read the story. It actually came out. Lengyel was a playwright and a writer of stories. And it appeared in a magazine, actually. And Bartok read that. And he actually saw the beauty in it, too. He saw the darkness, but he also saw the beauty in it. And he immediately had musical ideas about writing a work for it. And he actually contacted Lengyel at a certain point, and the two of them got together, and Bartok played some of it for him on the piano. And they became very close friends after that. So, yeah, Bartok wrote this around 1919, so right at the end of the First World War. And he was trying to create kind of the feeling of what was going on at that time, kind of this urban chaos and industrialization that was going on, of course, all the carnage and turmoil that happened at that time, too. So we hear that at the very beginning of the piece.
Sort of a musical onomatopoeia.
Of the surroundings.
Of street noise and, exactly. Sort of cacophony of the city.
And then he goes right to the story, and he tells it fairly literally about what actually happened. So you have these three kind of thieves, and they find a girl, a young woman, and have her come up to this window in this apartment so that she can lure unsuspecting men upstairs, at which point the thieves would rob and beat up this person and throw them out, which is what happens. And the music illustrates that very well, actually. And then finally, the Mandarin is the third person who comes up, and they see him as he's kind of the symbol of wealth and power. And when they bring him up, he develops a strange fascination and obsession with the girl. And actually, there is a huge chase scene that we actually hear in the music when he actually starts to move after her. Now, if you're playing the complete work, there is a type of redemption in the end. The three thieves actually pounce on the Mandarin and try to kill him, and they're unable to. They've done everything from suffocating him, stabbing him, and hanging him, and his wounds. He just won't die. And
He dies when he finds the girl's embrace, right?
Exactly. She seems to suddenly comprehend. If you read any kind of story of it, it says she comprehends or she understands. She starts to understand him, and they passionately embrace. And only after that point, he finally dies.
Now the suite is performed far more than the ballet. In fact, I think the ballet is rarely done, if ever, anymore as a ballet.
It's true.
And sometimes the whole ballet score will be performed as a concert piece. But really, the suite is probably the most readily available way of actually hearing this piece.
Yeah, by far, it's performed much more often. It's about 20 minutes or so if you do the suite version, which is what we're doing. And there's only really about 12 more minutes, 13 more minutes or so if you play the complete. But it is different. Bartok knew that it would be more practical for him to arrange it as the suite where it could end there. And that's exactly what we're going to do.
Now, when you think of a story like this, that the music was informed in its composition by this story, is this something you keep in mind or
Absolutely.
Try to connect with the orchestra?
Absolutely. In fact, I was talking to the orchestra last night in rehearsal about what was going on. And although you could simply play the notes the way they're written and follow all the indications, you would still have a very good performance of it because Bartok is so specific about how everything fits together. But when you understand what's happening, you get kind of into the mind of him a little bit more. You understand the character of why are we having to go faster here? But you can feel like, oh, okay, and this is where the first customer is coming up the stairs, and this is where he's getting thrown out. And there are even moments that are kind of comical within this kind of dark tale.
Yeah. Does it come out of the fact that the first two customers have no money to begin with?
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly right. They tackle them and find out that they have no money. So it's like, well, we don't have any money either. So they throw him back out. Of course, when they see the wealthy Mandarin, they think we've hit the jackpot.
Right.
We can get him up here.
Of course, now, not only is this story sort of unique to its period, but it's also a unique point of musical composition. This is a time of immense experimentation with the symphony orchestra. Schoenberg and Stravinsky have shown us everything that you can do with an orchestra. And so people like Bartok are looking at new ways of expressing. And there's all sorts of interesting techniques that he uses within the orchestra.
Absolutely. The Rite of Spring had just been premiered, 5 years before the composition of the Bartok Miraculous Mandarin. And so that was already, you know, a riot that occurred there at that performance. And even as you mentioned, when it was performed finally in Cologne, the Miraculous Mandarin, 1926, it had to wait another 7 years or so to be premiered. It was booed. It became a huge scandal at the time. And this is very progressive music, of course, for the time. But come on, the Rite of Spring already had been performed. And so, yeah, Bartok has his unique language. It just sounds like Bartok. If you're familiar with any of Bartok's works, you'll hear what he does. He does these kind of eerily delicate kind of gestures in the music, but he also has the kind of the brute force at times too. But it's signature Bartok, and much of it is very cinematic, you might say, in nature. It really sounds like just an amazing kind of soundtrack. It could be a soundtrack for a movie, but that I don't want to put it on a secondary level. It's the music itself, I think, is so evocative and fascinating, all the colors that he gets from the orchestra.
And there's all sorts of techniques that members of the orchestra are using, trills in the flute, flutter tonguing in the flutes.
Mm-hmm. The way he is able to combine even percussion with certain timbres that he's able to elicit from the strings with their particular playing techniques too, and the winds, it's really fascinating how he creates the different colors in a very, very different way than anyone else.
Now, Angela, you'll be playing bass clarinet on that, is that right?
Bass clarinet and B-flat clarinet.
Oh, uh-huh. What are the challenges of that for that?
Oh, goodness. Where to begin? This piece, as all Tulsa Symphony programs are, was chosen by musicians, and this was one that we had talked about for years on the artistic committee and wanting to program. And the clarinetists, of course, were the biggest advocates because it's amazing. It's a huge work for clarinet. So, in fact, the decoy games that happen three times are represented by the principal clarinet sound, and then it's just a huge part for all three instruments, all the woodwinds really. There's E-flat clarinet in there, and they're just wailing, and it's extraordinarily difficult, and perhaps we're wondering why we wanted so badly to program it, but it's going really well, and just the effects and the colors that are achieved are really exciting, and it's really fun.
And when you say you're wailing, you literally are wailing, right?
Literally so, wailing, yes. Uh-huh. There's some trills that they're very hard, but they're supposed to just sound, you know, just frantic.
Absolutely. I mean, this, you have to imagine if the clarinets are personifying the feelings, for example, of the young woman. I mean, she's terrified. She does not know what's going to happen. I mean, she's already demeaned by being put up there, and she's being coerced to stand in this window to bring up these people. So she's a very central character to the whole thing. It's called Miraculous Mandarin, so he also figures in. But the way that it has to be played is sometimes like she's trying to lure, but also with fear that's going on at times. So it's a kind of complex emotion that has to be brought out. And at times, it's supposed to be absolutely shrill and cacophonous because that's what's actually happening inside. So it's sometimes the internal struggle that's coming out as well.
Well, let's hear a little music from the Miraculous Mandarin. This is from the end of the suite.
The end of the suite.
What's going on during this
little
passage?
At this point, the Miraculous Mandarin, he's developed this incredible attraction to her, and he starts to become obsessed. And he starts to, and of course, the other three guys are still hiding behind the curtains because they want to make sure that they get him in kind of his weakest moment, and then they'll, you know, rob him and get his money. But he lunges for her, and they didn't expect that. And then that's when they're coming out of the woodwork there to kind of get him. So there's just pandemonium that's happening where he's chasing after the young woman, and they're out there also chasing. And that's when we have this brutal kind of maniacal chase scene. You might say the best that's ever been written, and that's how
Keystone,
we close.
Not Keystone Cops.
Yeah, no. No, this is more sinister. But it's amazing music. I mean, to feel that if your pulse rate doesn't go up when you hear it, there's something wrong with you, I think.
Well, so, let's hear a little bit of it. Here's music from the Miraculous Mandarin, which will be a part of the Tulsa Symphony as they open their season with a gala concert Saturday night, along with soloist John Kimura Parker, as we hear music by Bartok. That's music from The Miraculous Mandarin by Bartok. My guests today are Daniel Heggie, the principal guest conductor, also joined by a member of the orchestra, Angela Carter, who plays clarinet and bass clarinet in the orchestra. She's also the development director, which also plays a role in the gala concert, as well as this is a big fundraising event for the symphony. But earlier you mentioned the programming committee, and this is something that, you know, I've talked with various conductors. It's like, well, you know, I come in and I conduct because the programming committee of the orchestra, the musicians themselves, pick the programming. So what is it like to be in one of those meetings?
It is very interesting. Tulsa Symphony was founded on the principle, among other things, that it would be musician-led, and in the absence of a artistic director or music director, there is this committee called the Artistic Committee in its place, and they are responsible for all of the programming and selecting the conductors and the soloists. And as such, there is not one person making the decision. There's many people. So the first thing I will note about this process is it's much slower than it would be if one person were making these decisions inside one's own head. But having said that, it's really informative to have a group of people, most of whom are musicians, a couple board members, and they're all bringing different things to the table. So from education to their experience performing all over the world and their studies, and they have different opinions and have just a wealth of experience that they're putting towards these programs. And so we end up getting a lot of input from different players, and Daniel comes in and gives his two cents as well, and we put together possible programs, and then it's kind of a really long process of elimination and then determining soloists' availability and conductors, and but it all comes together. And I think, maybe speaking out of turn here, but we've had a number of conductors that have said, I would never have thought of this. This is not something that I would have put together, but you know what? It actually works.
And have you had that experience?
Well, I've looked at some of the programs and said, are you sure you want to do these pieces together? If you are, that's fine. It's that I can conduct it. That's fine. And so they're usually quite ambitious, but they're very exciting. And the wonderful thing, though, about the system that they have here is that there is a lot of buy-in from them. So if they say, well, yeah, we programmed it, I mean, they're going to sit up, they're going to learn the part, and we're going to rehearse it, and we're going to play a really good concert.
I can think of several concerts where it's just a matter of the sheer amount of new music going before the orchestra was like, well, that was very ambitious, because it was, you know, not one new piece, which, you know, a lot of times an orchestra will do that, but it's like two or three sometimes on a program. Is that just from the orchestra committee saying, you know, we want to play this amazing music?
It's a number of things that go into it, and that's where the expertise of the different people really does help, because we have, for instance, our music librarian is part of the committee, and so he will say, from a perspective of a, you know, the string parts or something, then this is a factor, this is a consideration, and then a brass player will weigh in and say, you know, that's really too much, you know, on one half of a program, and then a staff member will say, well, from what I've spoken to patrons on the phone and what they're requesting, they really want to hear a little of this. And so there's just a collaboration that involves so many different points of view. And that's how we get there.
Now, one interesting thing about you and your husband, David, you're both members of the orchestra in the same section, which, you know, that could be really a great experience, or maybe not so great experience, depending on what's happening at home. But you're also running various departments of the orchestra.
Yes, we are what TSO calls executive musicians, and we hold a dual appointment in the orchestra, both our chairs in the orchestra, David as principal clarinetist and education director, and then myself as third and bass clarinet and development director. And there are about five of us right now that are these executive musicians, and I really think that there is something valuable that other orchestras are doing. I mean, there are a few that are doing versions of this, but what we've created here in Tulsa is entirely unique in the way that we are doing, inventing this new model. And we avoid that division between the management and the musicians because we are both. And so on every committee meeting, you know, we sit on and they say, well, couldn't the musicians do this? And we say, well, no, because this is what that sounds like to a musician, and we know that perspective, and we can empathize. Now, it can always be improved, of course, but that empathy, I think, is key, and we're building on it all the time, and it's really something special, I think.
Well, I imagine both of you are gathering, like, this amazing new sets of skills from, mm-hmm. from, you know, just from your musical background to this management skill, mm-hmm. I would think.
Yeah. Oh, we're very grateful for that opportunity. But it makes a lot of sense. I mean, that was the premise, was that musicians, in addition to their skills that they've crafted over decades in the practice room, typically they have a lot of education and some other skills that can be built. And really, it's valuable to have people speaking to the patrons that know what it's like to be up there on the stage. And so I have so many meetings with donors that they come to all the concerts and they have so many questions, and I can speak about what that felt like and what the rehearsal was like and something funny that happened and sharing the real story behind the scenes. And I think that's very valuable, and people seem to appreciate that connection.
I think as a development director, you have this incredibly vested interest in your own product.
Yeah, I'm invested.
That's a hard thing about, is making that ask. But when you actually totally believe in the product, 2,000% by being a musician within the orchestra, it makes it a lot easier.
My own sweat and blood into the effort.
My guests today are Angela Carter, who's a clarinet and bass clarinetist and development director for the Tulsa Symphony, and Daniel Hagee, the principal guest conductor, as the Tulsa Symphony opens its season with a gala concert featuring John Kimura Parker playing the Brahms Concerto No. 2. And this is the other big work on the concert. And have you worked with John several
many
times?
Many times in the past. So I'm very excited. I just saw him today, and it's going to be great to work with him again. And it's funny because over the years we've talked about Brahms' Second Piano Concerto, and we say, hey, do you play this? Oh, I love that. So we keep thinking, man, I hope that works out sometime for us to play together on that piece. And here it's going to happen.
Yeah, and of course the second concerto, the first concerto is great, but the second concerto is sort of this different animal, isn't it?
It is. It's in four movements instead of three. Three is more traditional classical.
It's like a symphony with
really
piano
is.
And orchestra.
It's like a symphony. It is symphonic, but it's not just for the orchestra, but for the piano too. It's just enormous. If you ask, and I've done this, I've asked a number of pianists, okay, what's the hardest piece in the repertoire? And they say it's a tie between Rachmaninoff Third Piano Concerto and Brahms Second Piano Concerto. I mean, you really, it's an absolutely miraculous work in a way, because it inhabits a new sphere other than the D minor one, the first piano concerto, where Brahms, he's 26 years old in the first piano concerto, and for Brahms, he seems almost uncharacteristically with his heart on his sleeve. You know, it's very direct. The second piano concerto has those moments too, but it's somehow more spiritual in many ways, I think. It has a lot of that that great directness that you get in the scherzo movement, second movement, but it also has these sublime movements, you know, big solo cello in the third movement, and this almost whimsical last movement, fourth movement. So it's a huge piece for any pianist to pull off, but John will do it.
Knowing the soloists as you do, does that make that journey a little easier?
It does going into it, I think, because you kind of know what you're going to get. You're going to get fantastic artistry from him, and he's great to work with. He's one of those soloists who know how to listen to the orchestra and how his part fits in so well. He knows exactly what's going on in the orchestra, and that's always very useful. Rather than just simply trying to follow and accompany, you're really working together in a very collaborative way.
Yeah. And, of course, this is a major work, but actually the instrumentation for the orchestra is not that big, is it?
Right.
Do you play on that?
I'm not playing on that.
Yeah, no, it's a very small orchestra.
It's
a medium-sized orchestra.
Yeah, medium-sized. I mean, it's, Brahms comes from the kind of classical tradition, even though he's thoroughly a romantic composer, and he lived in that romantic period. And this is written in 1881, so that's right in the wheelhouse of when orchestras started to really expand and get much larger. But he doesn't have trombones or tuba or percussion. I mean, it's timpani, but really the pairs of woodwinds and the four horns, that's really where he puts it. But, you know, somehow Brahms is always able to, it sounds like it has these epic proportions of instruments up there, and they're really not. It's not such a huge orchestra. There's usually a generous bed of sound from the strings, so you still have a big string section. But somehow he's able to write in such a way, and I think it's just the profundity of his harmonic progressions and everything else that adds to that. But it creates this kind of big sound you're still used to. So when we say a bit smaller orchestra than the Bartok, for example, we're still going to hear a big orchestral sound on this work.
Yeah. Now, you as you mentioned, you're very familiar with John's work. But this is not a piece you've ever performed with him before, right?
No.
So what do you sit down with a soloist and try to get to an understanding before you stand before the orchestra?
Right. So we're probably going to get together and work through it. Usually I just like to listen to him play. I just want to hear him play. So he'll play through and I get already the idea of the tempos and things like that. And I also know where some of the connective points are where we have to really come together. And sometimes we discuss it and he'll say, you know, it's easier if you just conduct this and I play with you, however you're doing it. Or sometimes it's easier if I do this and you follow and we just talk about that. And I usually have him play a few passages a couple times so I really understand what his instincts are so I don't have to change anything. And I usually don't, especially with someone who's this experienced and this good, I don't make suggestions to him about how things need to go. Some conductors do that. They'll tell even experienced players, yeah, you might want to consider this. And I'm like, you know what? This is really about, you know, the soloist playing, and we need to try to serve that as much as possible. So I'm pretty deferential when it comes to that, just to see what their ideas are, and we try to fit those in.
Well, it sounds like it's a great concert with this Bartok and with has this Hungarian element, the Hungarian dances of Brahms, and then, of course, the Brahms Piano Concerto.
Yeah, monumental work in the second half.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with the program, both to you, Angela, and to the orchestra and you, Daniel. And thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Thanks.
Daniel Heggie is the principal guest conductor of the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra and will lead the orchestra in their gala concert. Angela Carter is a clarinetist, bass clarinetist, and executive musician with the orchestra. The symphony opens its seasons with that work you're hearing, the Brahms Piano Concerto No. 2, which will feature soloist John Kimura Parker in their opening gala concert Saturday evening at 8 o'clock at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. Visit TulsaSymphony.org for more information. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. We're going to leave you with music from the Brahms Piano Concerto No. 2.